Good morning. I would like to call a meeting of the Safety and Security Committee to order. I think we have appropriate, we do have the district, we have Maryland, we've got Virginia, and we've got a large turnout of federal members, so we're legal. Before we get started, a couple of administrative items. May I have a motion to approve the agenda?
No move.
And a second?
Second.
All in favor of the agenda?
Aye.
Aye. And the minutes of our prior meeting, December 18th meeting, may I have?
Move to accept the minutes of December 18th.
And moved and seconded, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye, any opposed? Okay, now that we've taken care of that, I'll introduce the meeting and introduce the guests that we have with us this morning to help us deal with the ongoing situation. As a member of the board and as chair of the Safety and Security Committee, I certainly am heartbroken about what occurred last week. We certainly extend our deepest condolences to the family of Carol Glover, who lost her life. We have apologized and continue to apologize to all our riders who were both inconvenienced or harmed, and we are absolutely committed to working within the staff, with the National Transportation Safety Board, and with all the other entities that are part of the review of what happened, to ultimately provide a full accounting of what happened. And we are committed to doing what we need to do in the future to regain our momentum in improving the safety of the system. I want to thank Acting National Transportation Safety Board Chair Christopher Hart for joining us this morning to help us better understand the NTSB investigative process and answer any questions the board may have about our roles and responsibilities, not about the incident itself, but about how we work with the board in these circumstances. Just to introduce Mr. Hart, he joined the safety board in 2009. He has been the vice chairman. He is currently the acting chairman of a somewhat diminished board. You're down to three out of five. Don't get in trouble, you won't have a quorum. Chris has held safety leadership positions in the past at the Federal Aviation Administration, as well as the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. He is the right person for the job he does. He will tell us about how the NTSB operates. I won't do that myself because he will do a better job than I. I would simply say that over several decades in this business, I have always relied on the National Transportation Safety Board to identify what has gone on in a situation, and their ability to help us work through what needs to be done is invaluable. Without being a participant in that investigation, we would be flying blind, and we appreciate the opportunity to work with them and the amount of attention they're giving, we are giving, and other parties are giving is extraordinary. And with that, let me turn it over to Mr. Hart. Oh, we need first to have a safety tip.
Thank you, Chairman Dowling. Yes. Good morning, and members of the board. Just in the event that we have a building alarm, we would ask that you exit through either doors to my right or left, cross Fifth Street, utilizing the crosswalks, and meet in the corner of the National Building Museum so that we can account for everyone. Also, in the event an AED is needed, we do have an AED right outside the door, but hopefully that will not be needed. Our safety contact for this morning deals with safety guidelines for portable electric space heaters, since this is the time of year that folks may utilize these devices. Portable electric and fuel-fired heaters have grown in popularity over the last two decades. However, this has come at a great cost. According to the National Fire Protection Association, based on 2007 to 2011 annual averages, space heaters accounted for one-third of home heating fires and 81% of home heating fire deaths. In 2011, heating equipment was involved in an estimated 53,600 reported U.S. home structure fires. To prevent mishaps, the following guidelines from the Consumer Product Safety Commission must be strictly adhered to. Never leave the heater operating when unattended. Never operate a heater you suspect is damaged. Before use, inspect the heater cord and plug for damage. Follow all operations and maintenance instructions. Never power the heater with an extension cord or power strip. Never run the heater's cord under rugs or carpeting. This can damage the cord, causing it and nearby objects to burn. Be sure to plug the heater, be sure the heater plug fits tightly in the wall outlet. If not, do not use the outlet to power the heater. During use, check frequently to determine if the heater plug or cord, wall outlet, or faceplate is hot. If the plug outlet or faceplate is hot, discontinue the use of the heater. Keep combustible materials at least 3 feet from the front, sides, and rear of the heater. Ensure the heater is placed on a stable, level surface and located where it will not be knocked over. To prevent electrical shocks and electrocutions, always keep electric heaters away from water and never touch an electric heater if you are wet. Thank you. That concludes my safety contact. Chairman Downey.
Thank you. Useful advice. Hopefully it will be heeded. Mr. Hart. Chairman Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Downey, for the opportunity to be here to discuss how the NTSB works and what's happened in this process. I'd like to start again, as you did, by expressing my condolences to Ms. Glover's family and offer wishes for a speedy recovery for those who were injured. So let me talk briefly, and then I guess the first thing I want to say is kudos to Mr. Downey and his team for how well they have cooperated with us in this investigation, because frankly we cannot really do it without them. So the cooperation has been great, and not only that, but kudos also for the as a party, since they're up close and personal with everything that we find as we find it. They have been quick to note areas that warrant improvement and to pursue those improvements. So kudos to you for doing that. That's one of the advantages of the party process, is that it allows the parties to see up close what's happening and where the problems were and what needs fixing, and you guys are moving forthwith on making those fixes. So let me start with a brief introduction about the NTSB. We are the federal agency to investigate transportation accidents in all modes of transportation. So Congress asked us, anytime something that moves has a mishap, we are there to find out why. And our investigations are for the purpose of prevention, i.e. finding out what went wrong and then make recommendations to prevent it from happening again, and not for the purpose of determining liability or blame. So we stay out of the blame game. We're not looking at liability. We're looking at what went wrong and what can be done to fix it. We do that with what we call a party process. We are a very small agency, so we rely heavily on the parties, not only because of our size, but also because we just don't have the expertise. We don't know the details, the ins and outs of how WMATA operates, so we need WMATA as a party in order to determine that. So we use parties, and then we form committees. We head each of the committees, and then we staff those committees with people from the party who have expertise in those various areas. So, for example, in this particular accident, let me tell you the groups that we formed, that we lead, and that the parties staff. The groups are an operations group, a survival factors group, a fire science group, a track group, mechanical, recorders, and civil engineering infrastructure. And those groups are staffed by the parties, and the parties are, in addition to WMATA, the Tri-State Oversight Committee, the D.C. Fire and EMS Department, the Metropolitan Police Department, the International Association of Firefighters, Local 36, the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 689, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Federal Transit Administration. So they are all parties to this investigation, and by being parties, again, they provide technical assistance to us because we don't have that technical expertise to know all these details that the parties would know, and so we rely heavily on their participation. And again, that enables the parties to be up close and personal with things as we find them and to make improvements if needed. So we put out some factual information about what we're doing so far in a preliminary report. I won't repeat that this morning, but I will talk about some of the things that are new since that preliminary report was put out, and talk about some of the issues that we are looking at, and this list of issues may expand as the investigation proceeds. We're looking at the ventilation system, i.e. the ventilation from the tunnels. We're looking at the response. We're looking at the evacuation system maintenance, train operations, and training and emergency exercises. So those are the issues we've identified so far that we're looking at, and again, that list of issues may expand as we go. This is a two-step process that starts with the factual collection, and that's where the parties participate in helping us gather all the facts. And then once the facts are gathered and we have vetted them through all the parties and make sure that we've got the total picture, because we don't We don't want to put out any facts before we have the total picture. So once they're gathered and we have the total picture, then we put out factual reports, and they are on the internet, available for everyone to see. That's phase one. Phase two, then, is the analysis phase, where we do the analysis based on the facts. We invite the parties to submit their own analysis as well, but the only formal official analysis is the one that we do, and the reason it's the only formal official analysis is because it's the unbiased one, because we don't have a dog in the fight. So everybody else, you would anticipate that everybody else would say it was their fault, not my fault, in their analysis. And they're welcome to do that, and we ask them to do that if they want and submit it. And that is also in the public record, but the only official analysis is ours. And by the way, excuse me, in order to help keep us out of the litigation process, because we don't want, we're not involved in liability or blame, our report is not admissible in court. So the facts are public, the report is public, but the report is not admissible in court. So let's talk about some of the, and by the way, that's a long process. That can take easily take a year, the totality of the process. But in the course of doing that, if we see issues that need immediate response, then we don't wait until the completion of that process to put out recommendations. We can put out immediate recommendations, and we did that in the Fort Totten accident in 2009. We put out several immediate recommendations. When we found the parasitic oscillation in the system, then the WMATA as a party was eager to fix it itself at WMATA, but we were concerned whether other transit systems around the country that had that same signaling system might have the same parasitic oscillation. So we put out a national recommendation saying, check and see if you have this kind of system, and if you do, check and see if you also have parasitic oscillation, as we found at WMATA, because that was the first time anybody had ever discovered that, and then we traced that back to several near misses that had that same cause that nobody was able to identify before, and it wasn't until Fort Totten that we finally identified the parasitic oscillation. So we will issue recommendations in the course of the event if we see issues that need immediate response. So let me talk about some of the facts that would not have that were not in the preliminary report, just to let you know where we are now. We made a preliminary examination of train 302. That's the one that moved out of the station, and the arc damage and the egress pass. That was egress both forward and backward, and more than 300 went back, either self-evacuated or were helped out of the station, out of the LaFont Plaza station. We don't have the number yet of the ones who went up the ventilation shaft, but we know that others went forward and egressed through the ventilation shaft. Since that time, we've had daily meetings with the parties to manage the investigation. We are very sensitive to the need for WMATA to return to normal operations, so we released the track to WMATA for normal operations the next morning. Both trains were moved to the yards, and we inspected the two trains inside and out, as well as the train, the third train that preceded train 302 through that area onto the yellow line. We've already conducted dozens of interviews with WMATA personnel. We have more interviews scheduled. We've since made several site visits to further document the conditions at the arcing location. The damaged cables and the cover board are in our lab and are being examined. We have a materials lab where we look at the situation and try to help us figure out, because everybody knows there was an arc. The question is why. So we've taken those to our lab to help us figure out why. We've also begun reviewing recorded data. We have many sources of recorded data. Train sources, signal sources, electrical system, dispatch center, there are lots of sources of data that we are looking at. We have extensive data, and that's going to take some time for us to go through all that and correlate it and make it all make sense together. We've conducted a preliminary functional test of the ventilation system on the ventilation shaft, and we were unable to exactly duplicate the configuration and sequence of the fan operations, and so we're going to reschedule further testing at a later date, but we did, in the course of doing that, we found some discrepancies in the operation of that ventilation shaft, of the ventilation shaft fan, so we're going to be digging into that deeper. We thank WMATA for the video that they gave us from about 100 security cameras, and we're viewing that closely to see if we can find anything. It's too early to say whether it's too smoky to be able to get useful information, but we're looking at quite a few cameras, and chances are out of those 100, we will get some useful information to help us in a number of things, develop a timeline to help us figure out what happened and help us with the rescue operation, because, as I said, in addition to finding out what went wrong and trying to prevent it, we also look at the recovery experts, the rescue experts, the first responders, and what they did to help minimize injury and fatality from the event. We'll also be reviewing recorded radio and telephone communications from the WMATA Operations Control Center, so that is yet to occur. We've received emergency response documentation from the DC Fire and EMS, and we're looking at that, and we've received almost 4,000 pages of documentation from WMATA already, including procedures, maintenance records, drawings, and logs. So we'll be scheduling additional interviews with firefighters, passengers, and WMATA personnel, And that's pretty much an update. I had a press conference yesterday to explain where we are. I mentioned all of these things in the press conference yesterday. We also had meetings with the mayor, the city council, and with the federal legislators, the senators and congressmen, to explain where we are. So we're actively trying to get the information out. We try to be very transparent, and transparency is crucial to what we do because we want the public to know that when we reach conclusions and make recommendations, we want the public to know the facts on which they are based, so that they will be comfortable knowing that we reach conclusions based on the facts and the evidence and not because the union lobbyists or the manufacturer lobbyists or the operator lobbyists or somebody lobbyists. So it's based on the facts and not the politics. So that is a brief description of what we do, how we do it, and where we are so far. And I'd be happy if I have time to take any questions you might have.
I'll open it up in a minute. I had one particular question, and that has to do with our ability and other parties' ability to communicate where they are, what they may have done in the past, what they may or have done in the future. It's my understanding that the time frame in which we would not comment is from the beginning of the incident to the end of the incident, and maybe some things that would lead to that, but we are able to talk about where we were and where we might be going.
Yes, that's a good point. I meant to cover that, and thank you for reminding me of that, Mr. Downey. We are very insistent that parties not go to the media about what happened in the course of about the investigation of the event and the investigation of the event, because inherently, and this is not, excuse me, this is not a criticism, inherently a party will have its bias in what it says to the media. So its bias is probably going to say, wasn't my fault, it was somebody else's fault. And that means all the other parties are going to be upset. We depend on the participation of the parties, and that means they have to feel that the process is fair. And when parties are on the media having a media battle about whose fault was it, then we lose the engagement of the parties because they don't feel the process is fair. So we are very strict about information to the media comes through us because we are the only ones who don't have a dog in the fight. We know the total picture, and we are the ones who would put out the unbiased information. So we don't like to put out bits and pieces of information because it can be taken out of context. We want the information. We want to wait until we have the totality of the situation before we put any information out. That relates to the incident itself. Anything that's historic, that's certainly, you're free to put that out. Anything in terms of improvements you're making because of what you've seen in the investigation, you're free to put that out. But the matters occurring in the that we are investigating, we are strong about not having parties go to the media with that, because then that is undoubtedly a biased account, which then gets the other parties upset because they want to put their bias on. So that leads to a rush to the media, and we have to nip that in the bud.
I may have some questions of staff when we get further into this, but let me open up for questions to Chairman Hart. Mr. Downs.
I'm going to follow up on the
you have the mic.
I was immensely discouraged to see an eruption.
I'm a longtime senior manager of this authority, giving what turned out to be false information to the media. It is a detriment to the authority. It's a detriment to all of us who work for the authority. It's a detriment to our commitment to not talking about details that we have committed publicly to the National Transportation Safety Board, to leaving the control both of the investigation and the dissemination of information to the National Transportation Safety Board. I would say to all employees of the authority, because we are a party to this investigation, that means the entire authority and everybody in it is committed to the implementation of that agreement, that contract, in effect. Any employee here, any level, who has a concern that they want addressed about this incident, have two channels that are legitimate in our way of viewing this. One is to take a concern to Jim Doherty as the authority's safety officer, designated as the prime contact to carry out this cooperative agreement with the National Transportation Safety Board. If an employee feels that they do not want to contact Mr. Doherty, their recourse is to directly contact the National Transportation Safety Board. I would encourage all of us to keep that in mind, because this is about our legitimacy in the pursuit of the truth about whatever happened here, and not leave any impression that we have other agendas other than getting to the bottom of this as quickly and as comprehensively as we can. I have to say again, I'm deeply disappointed about this.
Thank you for that comment. And we have, as the information technology advances and people are on social media, we're having increasing problems with employees of parties going to the social media, figuring, well, I'm just an employee, you know, who cares? But a lot of people care. And that's, you raise a very good point.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. Mr. Hart, I just want to get a tiny bit of clarification. You talked about the different phases of your work. So you do a factual report, and then you move into the analysis phase. And I know that any time frame you give us is approximate, because you're going to do what you need to do to close up one phase before you move to the next. But you mentioned a year, and I just want to clarify whether that year time frame that you mentioned was about getting to the factual report, or whether that was beyond the factual report. And it's really just for the listening public and for all of our writers, so people understand. You know, I think, as well as we do, that those of us who sit on these boards, we're in a tough position where we want to comply. We agree with you. You are the neutral party. At the same time, every place I go in my community, I'm getting questions. So if you could clarify the time frames, that would help us.
Thank you. The time frame I was referring to is the total time frame from event to completion of facts, analysis, vote on by the board, determination of probable cause, and issuance of recommendations. So we try to do major events within a year. And the reason, because everybody, of course, asks us, why does it take so long? The reason is because we do very exhaustive investigations. Just in this one, for example, we have easily over 100 witnesses to interview. So that in itself is time-consuming. We've got to put together information from lots of different sources. Our goal is not to just determine what happened. We know what happened. There was an arc. The question is why, and what can we do to prevent it? And it's the why and how to prevent it from happening again that takes the much deeper, much more thorough investigation.
Thank you very much.
And as the chairman said, if things arise that need to be recommended before the final report, we will hear about that. We are also free and encouraged to make improvements where we know they are needed and not wait even for recommendations. We'll talk about some of those this morning. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. Mr. Hart, just to clarify for Ms. Lenz's question, your end result will be a report that will both provide a determination of probable cause as well as recommendations. But prior to that point, would you also be intending to have a public hearing on this incident?
I would expect that in this case we probably will, because of the magnitude of the issues involved and in the public hearing. And thank you for, excuse me, reminding me of that, because I meant to mention that as well, that in the course of gathering the facts, part of the fact-gathering process will probably be a public hearing. That's something that the board has to vote on. As Mort says, we're only three of us now, but I will be surprised if the board doesn't vote to have a public hearing. And that would, my guesstimate would be, that would be a June time frame thing. Before that happens, we would put all of the facts that we have up until that time on the public docket so the public can see it, because that informs the public hearing as well. So I would say it's likely that we would have a public hearing.
And the other thing I just wanted to clear up is, in terms of immediate recommendations, you mentioned that you had provided those recommendations in the case of the Red Line accident in 2009. I know you've done it in the air transportation environment, but lithium batteries. Do you have any immediate recommendations that you would bring to WMATA today, or that you would expect to bring to us in the next week or 10 days?
That's a good question. It's too early to tell at this point. We may have immediate recommendations. We know WMATA's already, and you're going to hear from Mr. Downey, that WMATA's already taking steps on several issues. If this is just a local issue, then that wouldn't need a recommendation. If it's an issue that has national ramifications, then that's when we would issue a recommendation to have others look at it, just like we did in Fort Totten. Others with that same signal system, we wanted them to see if they also had parasitic oscillation.
And just following up on the potential hearing in June. It's my understanding that's a hearing in which all the parties take place and, in fact, can question each other as the hearing goes forward. It's not simply the safety board questioning the parties.
That's correct. It's a public hearing, so it's open to the public, and all the parties have an opportunity to ask questions of the other parties, which informs the process itself. That's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Hart? I have said a couple of questions for staff. You're free to stay, go, whatever, get back to work, whatever is good for you.
I'd like to stay if I can. Thank
please,
you.
Please, please do. First off, as mentioned, we have begun to take some actions, or at least evaluate certain actions that may be taken. I think the board members have at their place a memo that identifies 10 steps that we feel should be taken. We actually provided this to the members of Congress last night. They were happy to hear that things are moving forward, and I'd ask Jack and Rob to tell us what these are. Not in detail, some of them are pretty complicated, but just so that there's a sense we're looking at anything that might have, might make a future circumstance better than the one we had last week.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just mentioned, as Mr. Hart said, as the NTSB finds things that they would like us to look at, we certainly do that. And as during the process, Mr. Troop and Mr. Doherty have come up with some recommendations of things that we should, suggestions that we should explore. And we have to share those with the NTSB, which we have done. And they have concurred that we should explore these options. I'll ask Mr. Troop to speak to these.
And we will ask you to put each of these on our corrective action program list so that we'll track what's done with them and when they are either proven not to be helpful or implemented. We don't lose track of these things.
Yeah, there's a number of items that we have put forward initially here. The first is to write a standard operating procedure where the operator will immediately cut the environmental controls on the train. This is the air intake and the controls the heat and air conditioning for the train immediately upon seeing smoke. Currently, the SOP requires the RCC to tell the operator to do this, but we have looked at this and we have made a determination that it would make more sense for the operator once he encounters smoke to be able to do that. Secondly, one of the issues through the investigation, what we wanted to look at was incident management in the RCC to avoid crosstalk, to avoid confusion in the RCC, any items in there. And again, this is specifically that people stay in the seats where they need to stay, that that the people who are handling the incident are not distracted by the incident, and it is to formalize that process. Again, this is simply to formalize that process in the Rail Operations Command Center. Also, in cooperation with the Transit Police, OEM, and Safety, we are going to set quarterly drills for the next 3 years, where these will be on-track wayside drills. And depending upon the extent of what the Transit Police wants to do, we will invite the jurisdictions to participate into those. And these will be various ones. These will be on elevated sections, on tunnel sections, within stations, and they may entail different types of scenarios. They may just be smoke, but it may be other issues as well that we know that we may encounter in the system. The other thing is to design and implement exterior signage for emergency access. OEM, in cooperation with the our Office of Emergency Management, working on direction of the Transit Police, and again with support from Safety, goes to great efforts to train local jurisdiction first responders in how to get into our trains, the methods and means to do that. However, in the event that one of those first responders has not been trained, we want to have how these trains are configured so that it's easily identifiable to them to be able to know where they can get in, and the methods to be able to do that. So this is something that we will be implementing immediately. We also are providing an engineering and operations report. They'll work in concert with each other to look at the tunnel sections for condition and installation where the third rail jumpers are. So this is to make an assessment of all similar installations like this to make a report on that so that we can get an idea of what we are dealing with as far as condition and installation on that. Also, it's a recommendation for low smoke, low halogen for these specific third rail cables. I do want to stress that we are currently engaged in putting in low smoke for our feeder cables and our return cables. These jumper cables were to be replaced as part of our third rail replacement program. The question is, and what this recommendation will provide, this is an internal recommendation from WMATA, will provide is whether we want to accelerate that or not. And again, a lot of that will be based on the condition and assessment report that is done by the engineering and operations group. Where installations are found to have problems with the installation over time, these cables can start leaning against tunnel sections where we might have vibration issues against steel tunnel liners, against third rail cover boards. We will provide specific mechanical protection for these cables. And again, that'll be defined by the report that is issued, and we are engaging in that work now. Item eight is the review of the ground fault detectors and the third rail circuit breakers. This is just simply a system-wide check of all the third rail breakers, the settings on these, how we look at those to make sure that they're properly set. The operational analysis of running trains at 45 miles in the core with limited acceleration. Again, this is simply a study that we want to look at, and this helps inform the NTSB of any future recommendations that they might want to make. Again, this is part of the analysis that we're doing, that we're assisting in the investigation on this, and this is a opportunity maybe to minimize the amount of current that we have going through the system. Again, this is not causative. This is simply, to be able to do the analysis on that and how this would impact capacity, if in fact it would have any impact on capacity. So it's important that we do these types of studies. In addition, we are going to, again, do a report on zone smoke detectors utilizing our emergency trip stations, current infrastructure that we have in the emergency trip stations, all there's infrastructure that reports back to OCC to provide smoke detectors as a bolt-on to these, and again, this is a report, or using wireless technology for the smoke detectors. I do want to point out that smoke detectors are very difficult in a tunnel environment, in a railroad tunnel environment, because of diesel fumes, because of brake dust, because of dust that we have, where we do not want a number of false activations on that. So, look, it's important for us to look at this technology very comprehensively. On that. So, and that's simply to provide a recommendation. We have our engineers engaged in that to be able to provide those recommendations. In addition, as Mr. Hart said, as Chairman Hart said, as the investigation unfolds, there may be more of these specific items that come out. One of the things we have done is because we have recognized the anomalies in the ventilation shafts, we have immediately begun checking every single ventilation shaft to ensure that the operation is correct on that. And we are currently engaged in that, our engineering and operations group, and again, supported by safety in that check. So those are the items that we're currently under engaged. And like I said, what's important for me personally to be involved in the investigation is to be able to move these items forward very, very quickly as we see that the investigation unfolds.
And as we said, this is a mix of things that one case has already been done. Other things will be done in relatively short order. Others are things we'll evaluate, but you'll continue to add to the list and we'll continue to track progress on them. I just had a couple of quick questions on these. On the exterior signage, that complements what's already in the cars as interior signage.
That's correct.
And I think we'll be taking a look at those interior signs again to be sure that they're clear and that people understand what their means of egress are, but they are consistent across the entire fleet as far as what to do. The other on the quarterly drills,
yes,
that are proposed, I would hope that we would get, probably as part of the chief's regular reports, a status on how many drills have been held, who have they been held with, and certainly let our members from various jurisdictions know that their jurisdictions are, in fact, participating. We can't compel them to participate. But as we all know, they are the first line of defense when there is an incident, they respond, and they, in fact, become the commander on scene. So it's really important that they be part of that. We do have a list of the 5,422 responders who were trained last year, but it was a mix, more from some jurisdictions than others.
And
we
again,
really need to do that.
And thank you, Chairman. And I think what is important is that, again, this is why we're scheduling these out in 3 years,
right,
so that the time frame is understood and the ability for the jurisdictions to anticipate.
And the timing of that would be worked with the jurisdiction
exactly,
as to when they could make their folks available.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chuba, I wanted to say thank you for this. I think it's reassuring, not just for the board members, but for the riding public, to know that we are not waiting for the results of a complete investigation to begin to make improvements in procedures. But I would just suggest that and I know you got this document out very quickly, that is terrific. But I think if anyone in the general public were to read it, they would have no idea what it says. And I think our riding public deserves to know what we're doing. So may I make some suggestions about a document that we could release for the public, for the riding public, that would include diagrams, because some of this is very technical, that would have no acronyms so people would know what we're talking about, that would explain why we're looking at particular things, what it is that we're concerned about or investigating. So what's the delta from the status quo? You know, are we being more specific in our SOP? Are we being more frequent in our training? Is it a new action or a different procedure? I think that would help people, know a lot more about what the implication of all this is, and I think they would very much appreciate it.
We were asked by the members of Congress last night to get a document to them in their language, and that's, in fact, what
we're
working on.
I'm really mostly concerned about the riding public, right, because everyone's stepping on a Metro train like I did every day, and they want to know, if they were in a similar situation, what would they do differently? And I'll raise one point in particular that is a matter of concern to me, and I know that we all have electronic devices. And you can text, you can tweet, you can call, you can maybe pop up your own website in the event of an emergency. But one of the things that people don't seem to have inside the cars is necessarily a very precise information about their location, because they've been listening to music and playing video games and watching movies while the train's going. They don't even know what stations that they've come to necessarily. So people are calling and sometimes giving, with every good intention, terrible information about where they actually are and where the emergency is. So I think that might be something that could be very helpful, because we're not going to be able to stop people from acting on their own behalf. But having maybe even a continuous strip of information inside the tunnels that would give you mileage markers and let you know where you are between stations or something like that. So when that inevitable bunch of calls come in, that people have the best shot of being able to provide precise information. And if there's an emergency on their car, you know, what their car number is. And again, you know, this should be like a little card that we can hand out to riders about what to do in the event of an emergency. Just a suggestion.
Ms. Golden.
And Mr. Shoup, just two questions. Your memo here, your paper, has a number of very aggressive completion schedules. I just want to make sure that I understand what they mean. For example, on item 3 with the scheduling of the emergency quarterly drills with the jurisdictions, that January 26th completion date is a date when we're going to have a schedule of when those drills will be over the next extended period in coordination with the jurisdictions, or that's going to be a proposal from WMATA to the jurisdictions as to prospective dates?
It'll be a proposal. So it'll be for us to be able to identify the potential for the dates that we know. Work with the various elements that we have out there during things like Cherry Blossom Festival, working around that, working around the construction schedules that we have, being able to make sure we have a proposal to them and say these are the dates that are available and can these be timed. So it is putting forth a proposal.
Work around the World Series for next year.
And when do you think you would have, after consultation with the jurisdictions, an actual schedule of these various quarterly reviews that you could then provide to board members and provide to the jurisdictions?
Yeah, I think that's going to take a little bit of time. I would hopefully say by early spring, because we're going to use the conduit of the Council of Governments to help coordinate some of that. So the Council of Governments has a variety of working groups, and we would go through the COG fire chiefs, which we actively participate on. So we rely on them to help be that conduit to help schedule that.
And we've been asked to participate in that session at the COG on this very subject in the next few weeks, and it'll be an opportunity to introduce that.
I'm sorry, just one more question. Oh, I'm sorry. That is sort of different from some of the other items. For example, on item 8, the review of the ground fault detectors on the third rail breakers, where you have a February 27th. So that's an actual completion date when that analysis, that review will be completed.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to follow up on the issue you just raised regarding the quarterly drills. Do we anticipate a sort of complete analysis of what happened, what worked, what didn't work as it relates to the first responders in the jurisdictions? In the early conversations I've had with the county executive in Prince George's County, of course, after lamenting the fact that this happened and expressing condolences, one of the most important things I think for all of us is what did we learn? So in addition to the drills that obviously will train and enhance capability, will we get sort of a things to do, things not to do from the jurisdiction's perspective to ensure that we learn from this incident? I have to say that at Howard University, we were humbled and honored to treat a number of the people who were injured. And we've spent time since the incident assessing what worked, what didn't work, in fact, so that we're prepared. So certainly in terms of the jurisdictions, we would look forward to something like that.
As the investigation unfolds, and again, this, you know, without compromising our ability to work with the NTSB, as the investigation unfolds, it's important for us to identify those areas and be able to work with the jurisdictions, certainly from the chief's perspective, to be able to put that information forward so that we can do these and make it better.
And those aspects of post-event treatment will be part of the safety board's review. Right? So we'll gain from that process as well. Although I would note that process in this incident will only include the DC responders, but as it's developed, we can get it available to all of the responders. Mr. Downs.
Two quick points. I think it's important to note that while we have been doing training on a predictable schedule every year, and this is a proposal to do it 3 years in advance, it's also important to recognize that participation in this training is voluntary among the jurisdictions. Each jurisdiction picks the number and type of individual that they want to participate in this training. I think at the end of the year, it would be good to have the chief tell us in an annual report of training who's been trained, what they've been trained in, and any assessment of things that we could be doing to encourage a broader participation equally among all of the jurisdiction staffs. I think an annual accountability would help everybody understand how to manage their resources. The other is a comment that to Harriet's information for the customer, a reminder that the 7,000 series cars have on each car in a window slot, in effect, a indication of where they are in the system, what the next station is, and an ability to know what car you're on. So that there is, as we bring the new fleet on, enhanced capabilities from that fleet replacement.
Even as we bring the additional cars on, we can ultimately go back to concepts in which that capability exists today but is not functioning.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So it is something is useful, and we should be doing it. Any other questions? I had one.
Just a comment. First of all, thank you for this information, and I understand the readiness of responding to the legislators yesterday and pulling this together, and I think it's very helpful. And it seems like there's probably a twofold document, a document for those of us and in the authority, and a document for our
public
that is much easier to synthesize what we're doing and why we're doing it and where we are. And in saying that, I think, as referenced earlier, we know we have a lot of regional partners that have been in this with us for a while, and in their response of wanting to be engaged in that. We mentioned the Council of Governments, but within the Council of Governments, the Transportation Planning Board. And so I think we can all utilize that as a way of actually making the information that we gather and the responses that we have to be comprehensive, because it's from all of those entities that we are going to be most helpful in solving any of our problems.
Understand the process. The protocol for emergency response is formally adopted by WMATA and each of the jurisdictions through the COG. The normal cycle for reviewing that is once every 3 years. We are exactly in that cycle now, so that within the next several months, there will be an updated set of protocols, hopefully with some learning experience from this and other events that have occurred. One more, Mr. Downs, and then we'll move on.
One of the things that became apparent in my conversations recently with a number of individuals is the erroneous assumption that the authority has a emergency fire first responder capacity itself. It's important to emphasize that we are totally dependent on jurisdiction staff in emergencies as first responders, whether it's police or fire or emergency medical. All of those capacities reside in our partner jurisdictions. It's important. So
with the participation of our police force.
Yes, with our police force being in effect, sometimes the enforcement side of the equation. But all of the protocols say the first responder on the scene is in charge of both the scene and the incident management. This process is working. It could work better. And our pledge, I think, is to make sure that we do everything we can to make this as easy and as transparent as we can about our partnership with the jurisdictions. But we do not have this capacity inside this authority.
Mr. Ewell, and I have one question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for being late, but as I indicated earlier in the week, I'm participating in the U.S. Conference of Mayors Mid-Year Convention in Washington, and so I was there first before I came here. Actually, I wasn't due to arrive here until 11 o'clock, but because I knew this was a topic of importance on the agenda today, I wanted to hear what NTSB and the dialogue amongst board members, but certainly have read an awful lot in the press, albeit not sure how accurate it is, precise. That's why I wanted to hear it and see it for myself. But certainly, in addition to being the mayor of the city of Alexandria, and certainly our citizens, our riders in the region, were concerned about what happened, the incident. And when folks ask me, is the system safe, I say, yes, it's safe. And but there's always work and room for improvement and enhancement, and that's what we're going to continue to do. And I don't know what all was said amongst the members and questioning staff, what have you, but I think what I'm hearing from a lot of folks that we must continue to do as much as we can, knowing that NTSB still has authority over the investigation, but not only is it transparency, but being able to say what we can say. When folks feel that we're holding back and hiding information and so forth, that certainly doesn't bode well for the authority or the system. But in addition to that, I'm now the chairman of the Board of Directors of the Council of Governments, and we have been in communication both with past chair, current chair, and leadership here at WMATA in terms of having a meeting together to focus on the protocol questions and issues, and I believe that's being scheduled as we speak. But I think the more we can have this public and open dialogue, the better it is and beneficial to our ridership and to the public as a whole. And then, again, it gets down to money. It's we know that we're an aging system, and it takes money, dollars, to do what we need to do, despite the fact that we have a planned capital improvement program, all of the above. But the dollars really the dedicated funding that we don't have, and that's what's important. And so hopefully everyone understands it. And unfortunately, the one individual that did succumb to the smoke on the train was a resident of my city, and I knew her and her family very well, and certainly attended her funeral. And you know, it's comforting to know they're comforted to know that there's a dialogue, ongoing dialogue with the authority as well, the family. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Euler. When we heard that the CARD wanted to have this meeting, we embraced it and said that is what we should be doing. We are all partners in the response process. We need to do that. I just had one more question on, in the context of not talking about the event itself, but things that happened before or things that have been done since. And I had been very concerned with respect to the radios. The impression was left and continues to be reported that we were told by district fire that the radio system did not work. And in what's been reported so far, that was end of story. Can you tell us what was done subsequent to that notice, but prior to the event, and also what may have been done subsequent to the event?
Let me start by saying that on January 7th, it was determined that there was spotty coverage and usage of DC fire radios in the system. So from the 7th to the 8th and over the weekend, our staff, realizing that it's our responsibility to maintain the radio system, looked for everything possible that we could find that might have we could correct to get the fire department radios working adequately. On the morning, by the end of the weekend, the staff had more questions than answers, and they contacted, the morning of the 12th, contacted the district personnel and indicated that we had an issue, we can't find the problem, we would like to enter your donor unit, which is donor site, which is a couple blocks from this location, and arrangements were made to have that joint effort done on the 14th of January.
And subsequent to the event?
And I think subsequent, Mr. Hart, I think it's fair to say that we met with the fire department. We found out that they had made some adjustments to their radio system, primarily through encryption of their system, which impacted our ability to have their radio system work within the system. We went back, made the modifications that we needed to make to allow that system to work. Those modifications were made on the 14th. Fire department tested their radios on the 14th, and the system was up and running and is running today.
So as of today, we have a working radio system.
We do, and that modification is for the entire system, not just for the LaFont location.
Thank you. And I would hope if the city fire department intends to issue a subsequent report that it would be more complete than the report that was issued previously. Anything else? I'm going to turn the meeting over to the vice chair for the other business, which probably shouldn't take very long. Again, welcome to stay and hear what we do as a safety committee. Or if not, we thank you for being here. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. We'll now move on to the regular quarterly review of the safety report, which is presented by Jim Dougherty. Again, Mr. Hart, you're welcome to stay and hear how we usually handle these quarterly safety issues. That will be followed by an annual security report from Chief Pavlik. For those of you who've looked at the early pre-agenda, the third part of the agenda, the cybersecurity report, due to time constraints, will be put off and will be scheduled on a future meeting of the Safety and Security Committee. Mr. Dougherty.
Thank you for offering for me to stay. Thank you for bringing me here in the first place, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to stay. I think at this point I'll probably take my leave, and please don't take that as a political protest.
I know you have a lot of work to do, but we thank you for being here.
Okay. Thank you, and good morning again. In regards to the Yellow Line incident, I just want to clarify for the board, committee, that my report for this quarter reflects data for the period of October through December 2014, or the fourth quarter. In comparing the employee injury rate for the fourth quarter with the same period last year, shows a 14% decrease, or a rate of 3.72 versus 4.34 per 200,000 hours worked. In the number of reportable injuries, the overall injury count decreased by 17 for the fourth quarter of calendar year 2014. Looking at the calendar year to date, the employee injury rate is also lower than the corporate target of less than 4 point injuries per 200,000 hours worked at 4.20. This is also 13% lower than where we ended last year. Again, there were 495 OSHA recordable employee injuries for benchmarking purposes against other agencies. The Bureau of Labor Statistics lists the average for transit and ground passenger transportation at 5.1 injuries per 200,000 hours worked. As the pie chart of injury types reflects, slips, trips, and falls continues to be the leading injury type for the fourth quarter with 30 occurrences. Additionally, with the exception of pursuit and arrest, all of the main injury types experienced year-over-year decreases. Slips, trips, and fall was the leading, the leading injury with 145 cases. Injuries related to employees being assaulted decreased 21% from 2013. Regarding WMATA's departments, 8 out of the 10 main offices experienced year-over-year rate decreases, and I will speak more on this in the upcoming slides. The 2014 employee injuries have trended downward, meaning fewer injuries than the previous year. Moving to other key performance indicators, the customer injury rate for the fourth quarter of 2014, again October, November, December average, was 1.92 per million passenger trips. The calendar year-to-date rate was 1.96. Both of these exceed the corporate target rate of less than 1.8 per million passenger trips. The top two quarter injury types, again, slips, trips, and falls at 65%. And vehicle collision-related injuries are 23%. The main key factors that contributed to the customer injuries were inattention, distraction, and preventable rear-end collisions. Preventable collisions, hard braking events, and non-preventable rear-end collisions, and that's where WMATA was rear-ended in these events. In the following slides, I will discuss in more detail the actions we're taking to reduce and tackle customer injuries. In drilling down into the bus customer injuries, the two major injury types are collision-related and slips, trips, and falls. Regarding the collision-related injuries, the majority of collision-related injuries come from non-preventable collisions. Some actions are improved defensive driver training, and the We Care program has improved operator response and interaction with the riding public. As far as the slips, trips, and falls and other injuries, we're training operators to avoid hard braking events by looking ahead and improving berthing locations has reduced falling injuries. In addition, providing customer outreach education on proper riding techniques, such as holding on to the handrails, helps with the slips, trips, and falls. Initial data review demonstrates a decrease in pedestrian injuries with buses equipped with the amber strobes that you may see on the top of some of the buses. In looking at rail customer injuries, there are basically three areas: escalators, or as we call vertical transportation, rail stations, and onboard the trains. For the vertical transportation injuries, we've seen a 19% year-over-year decrease in the customer injury rate. Decrease can be attributed to fewer injuries on escalators while they are in walker mode, which has correlates to the increase in escalator availability. For rail facilities, this year's rate is higher due to an abnormally high rate in January, followed by elevated rates in February and March. The rate increase for the first quarter can be attributed to the winter weather, as you may recall, the snow and the ice that occurred. Snow and ice removal methods have been improved, and a decrease in response time is anticipated this upcoming season. Our onboard incidents, they have a slight increase that can be attributed to patrons falling while the train is in motion or being caught in closing doors. Improvements are anticipated with the reintroduction to ATC and the 7000 series rail cars. Looking over the last 5 years reveals a positive improvement in both customer and employee injuries. The chart reflects that employee injury rate has decreased 28% when compared to calendar year 2010 rate. Some of the wide swings early on can be attributed to inconsistent injury investigations where corrective actions were applied locally and not necessarily shared departmental-wide, as well as multiple events where more than one employee was injured as a result of one incident. Through improved training, such as the defensive driving we mentioned, enhanced arrest tactics, these multiple injuries per event occurrences have decreased. Additionally, we began to see a sustained downward trend around mid-2012, which correlates to many management models that indicate a three-year time period is required for an organizational culture change to take hold. Many factors of the trend have been identified and will be touched on the next slide. For customer injuries, we are seeing a 6% decrease when compared to calendar year's 2010 rate. The variations in the rate are attributed to the weather events and multiple injuries where several passengers are injured as a result of one accident. As discussed earlier, infrastructure improvements enhance the customer's experience and improves the safety of the system overall. Employee injuries by department reveal some common traits among those with decreasing injuries. Some of the common traits of those departments that have consistent low injury rates are thorough injury investigations. The root cause of the investigation is identified and mitigated not only at the local level, but throughout the various departments. Learning via our local safety committees, those that have been injured are required to report to the next local safety committee to discuss the injury, causes, and opportunities where safety improvement may occur. This provides not only a multi-level review of the injury, but gives the employee a sense of ownership if and when their ideas are used. Non-punitive injury investigation, employees are free to discuss the factors that contributed to the injury without fear of being disciplined as a result. Potential decrease in questionable injuries, and that's upon hearing that all injuries are being investigated. Those that may have reported an injury to get out of work would think twice before doing so. Heavily involved involvement with the local safety committee, those departments that have well-attended and fully engaged local safety committees, or LSCs, also have the lowest injury rates. And active management and leadership in the safety via the local safety committees have also resulted in lower employee injury rates. Well-performing departments also incorporate safety into all aspects of the job, and not just having it as one part of the day. Also note that the two departments in red, track maintenance and plant maintenance, have employee injury rates that are consistently among the lowest, and even lower than our corporate target of less than 4.8. And those are the groups that are actively involved, and certainly two of the groups that have a potential for injuries. So we thank them and appreciate all their hard work as everyone working towards that goal of zero injuries. Here is an updated bar graph reflecting the number of open corrective action plans. As of December 31st, 2014, 81 caps have been closed. It is important to note that many of the cap closures are the result of WMATA's own internal safety and security reviews and aggressively addressing corrective actions, which were the result of accidents and incidents within the system. You note, through this quarter, there are no unacceptable hazards requiring corrective actions. There are 26 caps in the undesirable category, 33 caps in the acceptable with review by the Executive Safety Committee, and 23 caps with acceptable without review category. And as we... I'm sorry, sir.
By focusing on the more serious events, we brought that number to zero.
That's correct. And that would conclude my safety report. If anyone has any questions, and we will
come back with the annual report later this year.
I have one question, Mr. Dougherty, and I know Mr. Giancola has a question. If we go back to the customer injury rate chart for the full year, that's the one entitled Statistical Review, Customer Injury Rate per Million. I note there that the rate of injury, customer injury, took an uptick in November and December of last year. Do you have any explanation for that uptick? Is it on the bus side, on the rail side? Does it reflect a few isolated incidents, or is it a trend that you've spotted?
That has been a few of the incidents where we've had multiple injuries as a result, primarily on the bus side. And that, you know, there was one that was preventable, and I believe one that was non-preventable, Ryan, that occurred that accounted for many of the injuries where we had upwards of 8 individuals transported away from the scene. However, none that were actually hospitalized overnight.
So one-time bus injuries from bus.
Just a few of those. We had a couple in those months.
Thank you. Mr. Giacola?
Yes, thank you for the report. I'm looking at page 23 of 43, employee injury rate. And I'm certainly pleased with the overall results. But looking at plant maintenance and track maintenance, which just kind of stick out, I'm kind of curious whether or not, because we're doing more maintenance over the last couple of years in track and plant, whether that's a factor in this. In other words, there's more opportunity to have injury. But also, I was kind of curious whether we're determining from those injuries whether fatigue played a role. In other words, are we determining whether the particular employee or employees were, you know, at the start of their shift or at the end of their shift or were in a double shift? So do you have any statistics like that? And if not, certainly you could provide them later.
We're looking at that. Fatigue has now entered into the investigation. As you know, the policy went into actual effect January 1st of this year, even though we did have a soft time period last year. But we have looked at the fatigue, and in some of the accidents, and I will say more or less the vehicular accidents, fatigue has played a role. But we're also looking at the employee injuries, and I don't have that information today with me.
Thank you. Just a question. I understand that you mentioned corporate goals and 4.8 injury rate. How do those goals get set? Are they based on some notion of a continuous improvement from a baseline, or are these from a national number? Are we comparing ourselves to other systems? And my safety committee colleagues might already know the answer to this, so pardon me if it's a newbie question.
No, but it's good to get that answer from Mr. Dougherty directly.
We have looked at the benchmark that we go with the standard industrialized code that we look at that's irrelevant to our industry. However, that code is a key performance indicator that the staff meets on an annual basis, reviews what the prior year target was, if you will, and then we work to, you know, come up with a reduction that is then discussed between the general manager and the board to set that goal for the upcoming year. And it's been typically around a 5% reduction, usually on an annual basis.
Mr. Goldman, thank you. Mr. Dougherty, this issue that several people have sort of focused on, which is the injury rate, the customer injury rate, and your response several times that sometimes we have multiple injuries from a single incident. I have a memory that we used to have a chart that was sort of the next level down from this one that helped the board see how the number of incidents compared year over year, and I found that helpful. There's something kind of like it in the narrative report that you've provided, but it's not exactly what I remember. So I would just ask in the future, when we do this sum up at the end of each year, I think it is useful for us to look at the number of incidents as well as the number of customers, because what we want to see is, to the greatest extent possible, the preventable incidents falling and the overall incidence falling. And right now it's hard to sort of tease that out from the data that's before us.
Sure. And then we'll provide that with our annual report, if that's good. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Dougherty? Thank you, Mr. Dougherty. We also have Chief Pavlik on our agenda this morning to deliver the 2014 annual security report. Since members have had an opportunity to review the report in advance of today's meeting, I'd like to ask that in the interest of time, we forego the actual presentation from the chief, but if board members, individual board members have questions, I'm sure he would be happy to address them. I would like to note, though, that we saw a significant 27% reduction in Park One crime in 2014, including dramatically lower crime rates on Metro Rail and lower crime rates on Metrobus and in our parking facilities. And along with drastically lower crimes against property, there has been a noticeable drop in sexual harassment complaints. Perhaps, Chief, you could just address what are the Park One crimes so that everybody has an understanding of what that definition entails.
Certainly. Good morning, Mr. Goldman and members of the board. The FBI classifies what a Part 1 crime is. Your Part 1 crime is typically your violent crimes, any theft, rape, robbery, larceny, burglary, arson, aggravated assault. So those are your more violent crimes. Your Part 2 crimes are your more minor crimes, your simple assaults, other crimes that don't involve a weapon and things of that nature. So they're really classified in Part 1 and Part 2 crimes.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the chief this morning? I have one, but Ms. Porter has one as well.
I just wanted to follow up on the comment that you made about the reduction in sexual harassment complaints. I'm very pleased to see there's a reduction. I only note that a reduction could be the result of either fewer incidents or fewer incidents that happen being reported. And so I'm wondering, we had a very good campaign to let people know what they could do if they experienced or witnessed an incident of sexual harassment. Are we continuing to do those campaigns to let people know what they can do to report it?
We are. We are very actively with that, working with Ms. Barasox and her group is what we're doing. We have the website as one. They have an email that directly comes to my inbox, and then we also do it with employment engagement. So it's a multi-tiered approach. We start off first with a public campaign, and then now we'll drill down to employees. So employees on how you, empathy to how you talk to a victim of a sexual assault. So we'll start with the law enforcement side first. We already get that in our training, and then eventually work out to our frontline employees.
Are we continuing to do the public information campaign?
Yes, we always look for opportunities to do that. So one of our, you know, I look at our reduction of crime as a three-legged stool, and one of those are outreach events and education of our public. So we do that either whether through crime blitzes or safety blitzes, any opportunity where we're in the public's eye where we can share literature with them, facts with them, ways to protect their personal belongings and themselves. Yes, please.
Ms. Porter, we're working with the advocacy community right now in a refresher public campaign so that the information that becomes sort of wallpaper after a period of time in the system gets a new look and feel and gets new attention to it, and that will help promote the reporting of incidents when they do happen.
Chief, my question was also in this general area. There were reports earlier this month in the media about upskirting activities perpetrated on the metro system. So that raises two questions. The first is, in our categorization of events, do we categorize those as harassment actions? Do we report them in that category? And the second question is that I know, as we've talked, these are not criminal activity that we can actually prosecute, but what recommendations would you give to riders who experience or witness this kind of activity?
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, with that particular incident, the upskirting incident that got some media attention. Unfortunately, that is not a criminal act, because when you're in a public place, there's no expectation of privacy. It's unfortunate that some of those incidents occurred. As a father of three girls, I take that personally. But it is a civil matter. It's something that has to be handled in a civil way. So we've had one juvenile complainant come forward with her parents, and we are helping them in that avenue. But it's not something criminally that we can charge. It does not fall into the context of voyeurism that you often read about in the paper, where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. In those type of situations, you know, we always encourage our customers to, whether it's for that particular type of incident or any crime or criminal activity, be aware of your situational awareness. If you see someone holding a phone or a camera in a provocative manner, maybe, you know, readjust your body posture, your clothing, things of that nature. It's very challenging to deal with that, because we have so many riders and young riders at that, where oftentimes they don't realize they were a victim in this particular case. where these people were probably photographed or filmed without even being aware of it. So we are working with the local people to make that happen, but it, again, it's not a criminal matter, and it's more about your mannerisms, the way you conduct your conduct on transportation and how you dress, how you sit. A lot of those things could have been avoided, frankly, if they changed your body posture just by a little bit. So the particular individual took advantage of an opportunity, and unfortunately there's people like that that probably ride our system every day.
And in terms of tracking for statistics, are we classifying those as harassment, or are we having a separate category, or how do we track that kind of activity?
Well, in those particular ones, we wait for a victim to come forward. The harassment email is one way they report it, or sometimes in this particular case, once it did get media attention, we had people contact us, and we contact that or classify that in a different category. So it would not fall under this particular sexual harassment complaint.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldman, could I just follow up on that for a second? It occurs to me that this really is an education, you know, that there is an education of the public piece to this. And I'm remembering all the good work we've done with young people around the Respect Your Ride. And I just wonder whether there might be an element of giving those young people this an appropriate message around this as they move into it. It cuts both ways. I understand that. But for young women, I think, to understand that this is a way they can be taken advantage of.
We do. We're very blessed, especially here in the District of Columbia and Virginia, where the Respect Your Ride campaign has really taken off. We're seeing a lot more now in Prince George's County where we have opportunities to do that, and we will add this to part of our presentation. And really, it's just behavior and mannerisms, and that's really is. And like you said, ma'am, it's just more about education and awareness.
Ms. Porter?
I just wanted to mention generally that in the we have some very difficult issues that we're dealing with, but it is very good to see that we have a reduction in overall crime. So I think I appreciate some good news. Thank you.
Yeah, if I could just add my comments to that. I think the results almost speak for themselves, that the changes in policing and the attention that it's gotten has led to good results. I would also note over the last few months the substantial number of serious events that were rapidly resolved through the use of our resources. That in itself will also be a deterrent to crime. People should know if you do something in the metro station, you're going to get caught.
Now, let me chime in my commendations because we began a process with the previous chief that you have continued, which is regular meetings with the police chief in Prince George's County. And we certainly believe that that has made a tremendous impact on what we're seeing in the county. So I commend and thank you for that.
Thank you, Chief Pavlik. Is there any other business to come before the committee? If not, the committee stands adjourned till its next meeting next month, when we will have the briefing on cybersecurity. Thank you.